You're listening to episode 11 of the Tennis Files podcast with special guest Alistair McCaw.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey guys, welcome to an amazing episode of the Tennis Files Podcast. Today I spoke with world-class sports performance specialist and coach, Alistair McCaw. Alistair has coached some of the best tennis players in the world, including Grand Slam champions, and he's also trained elite athletes from other various sports. Alistair talked about how tennis players can become better athletes and what they need to do to really push themselves to reach the next level. And Alistair also had a lot of great advice for coaches and parents on their role and how they should be supporting the athlete. I really appreciate Alistair taking his time to be on the show today and for speaking with us. And I'm extremely excited for you guys to listen in on the interview. And I know that after listening to this episode, you're going to be extremely motivated and inspired to work really hard for your goals and to really set yourself apart from everyone else by pushing yourself and doing everything that you need to do to gain an edge. So without further ado, here is my interview with Alistair McCaw. Hey everyone, I'm here with Alistair McCaw, a world-class sports performance specialist. Alistair has worked with top tennis professionals such as Kevin Anderson, Svetlana Kuznetsova, Dinara Safina, Jelena Dokic, and Bernard Tomic. And Alistair has spoken about sports performance in over 25 countries. You can find him at themcawmethod.com. And he is just, you know, really one of the most passionate and motivational people that I've ever seen. I'm a big fan of his work. He posts a lot of amazing updates on his statuses on social media that are very motivational and really get you going in the morning. So, and anytime, really. So with that, I just want to welcome Alistair to the Tennis Files podcast. How are you doing, Alistair?
Awesome. Thanks so much for that introduction, and it's great to be here. Thank you.
Oh, yes. No worries, Alistair. Yeah, it's truly a pleasure and honor to have such a knowledgeable sports performance coach and specialist such as you on the show. So, Alistair, just tell us a bit about your background and such as your life growing up as an athlete and then how you got into coaching.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to make it too long and bore the listeners, but cut a long story short, born in Northern Ireland, actually in the same hospital as Rory McIlroy, another famous Irishman, the golfer, of course. Was brought up in South Africa in the 80s and 90s, was educated there. Started out as a tennis player when I was around about 9, got to a national level at 12, 13. Stopped it at 14 due to financial constraints in our family and just the difficulty back then during those times. There wasn't a lot of support from the federation or things like there is today. Took up running and became a pretty decent runner and duathlete and triathlete and went on to compete in 5 world championships. And during that time, just started working in a gym at the age of 16, actually cleaning the restrooms and vacuuming the floors in return for training at the gym, so it could supplement my training and my racing. And from there, grew a passion for the fitness industry, the strength and conditioning industry, being around like-minded people. And when I was 18, I became a fitness instructor. And then from there, personal training. Worked with Miss Universe, worked with a whole lot of celebrities in South Africa, and sports stars, rugby, cricket, which is obviously big sports down there. And that's basically how I got my start in the industry. So definitely it wasn't from a deep educational background, or I don't have the most qualifications, so to say. I do have a sports management diploma. I do have various certifications, but I would say my biggest achievement has just been getting out there and just working my butt off and just persisting and just following my passion.
That's amazing, Alistair. And was there a specific event that triggered the desire to get into coaching, or was this a gradual build-up that got you into this profession?
I think from a young age, you know, leadership comes through in your personality. I mean, I was reading an article the other day where they say by the age of five, you've already got a personality trait. You're either a leader or a follower or whatever. And that resonates with me when you watch young kids playing in the playground, for example. You'll see there'll be a leader. There'll be the more dominant ones, for example. So looking at that, I love to lead people. I love to always captain the soccer team or the tennis team or whatever it may be. And I think those qualities came through of loving to lead people and guide people into the coaching side, because it is about leadership, guidance, support, and helping others. So I think, you know, it starts early in your life with the type of personality you are. So I think that could be it.
And so, as we all know, passion is a huge and a very important part of what makes great coaches such as yourself. And what in particular makes you so passionate about being a coach, besides helping people? Or that could be the main thing, really.
Yeah, pretty simple answer there. It's people and seeing other people succeed. That is what coaching is all about. If you don't like to see others succeed and you don't like to help others get the best out of themselves, then you're not going to be passionate about coaching, because that is what coaching is all about. Coaching is not about egos. Coaching is not about yourself. It's about serving others, being there for others, and putting others first. So definitely that passion, you know, I grew from a young age. I just always loved to be helping people. I'd love to be taking that new kid in the group or that new teammate and taking them by around the arm and saying, hey, or around the shoulder and saying, hey, don't worry, I got you, you know. And I think that's what it's about. It's about loving people.
Yeah, Alistair, and I mean, really what coaches do can arguably be said to be the most important thing that people can do on the earth, because they're guiding people and helping them achieve their potential, and that is just a really, truly wonderful service.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. And so when a coach first starts a relationship with a tennis player or athlete, what would you say is the first thing that a coach should do in this situation?
Two things. Definitely having your standards set. You know, I always said all starts with your standards. And the standards you have for yourself, the standards you have for your company, your business, your environment you're working in, and the standards you have for your athletes. So it's important that those athletes or those clients you're going to be working with understand your standards. Standards are another way of saying rules. However, rules have a little bit of a negative type of feel to it, as in, okay, here are our rules, for example. Standards are more, let's say, acceptable, and they give the athlete more accountability and responsibility, like they are in charge of what they're doing. And they like that. Athletes like that. So that's an incredibly important thing, is they understand their standards. Second of all, connection. You cannot direct if you can't connect. And you can't change something in an athlete's program, especially an elite athlete, if they don't trust you. So there's got to be a connection there before you direct. And I think this is something that a lot of coaches make the big mistake, because they might see things right. They might see the changes that need done, but they come in there far too quickly wanting to fix things. And they haven't won the trust of the athlete to get into those areas and make the changes. So I think those two things, setting your standards and making the connection.
I've listened to a couple of your past interviews, and you have stressed a lot about the importance of a coach getting to know the player, and you've talked about, you know, getting to know their likes and dislikes. And can you kind of talk a bit about the strategies like that that will help forge the relationship closer?
Well, I mean, I can just give you an example. You know, before I started working with world champion in squash, Rami Ashour, 2 years ago, I didn't know that much about him. I knew he was a very successful athlete. He's 3-time world champion. He's been number one. So, you know, you see these things. However, I didn't know him personally. So it was important for me to do as much research as possible. Maybe like spy work, if you like, but knowing what he loves to do in his spare time, knowing what food he enjoys, knowing what his hobbies and his interests are, which countries he's been to, does he speak other languages, et cetera, et cetera. And tapping into those areas that when we sit down, we have a common interest, or we can find common interest to talk about, not just about squash, tennis, golf, whatever the sport may be of the athlete. So connection is made not through necessarily through the sport, or experiences in the specific sport, but in other life experiences. That is where coaches can win the connection with the athlete. And especially in today's world with technology, social media, you know, we have Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all these type of things. We as coaches need to embrace that. You know, you cannot have that attitude of, well, that's for the new younger generation and teenagers and so on and so forth. We need to, as coaches, embrace that, understand it, and go with it. And these are things that we can make a connection with today's generation, especially because we're dealing with the IY generation. IY generation is the internet generation born from 1994 and afterwards. And if we cannot tap into them and connect with them, we're going to have difficulty coaching them because it's not about the skills, drills, X's, and O's. It's about the connection we have with that person.
I did hear that you're actually reading a book or read a book on that topic. Can you tell us the name of that book? Is it The IY Generation?
IY Generation by Tim Elmore. It's a fantastic book that's definitely helped me understand this generation a little bit better and embrace this generation. I think there is a newer version that's come out, but it's definitely a book I'd recommend to all the listeners out there. I believe that the future coach, or today's coach and future coach, is someone that can connect with the generations that are coming through. Someone that is up to date with the changes in technology and embraces them. And, you know, that doesn't mean you have to be an IT expert or you have to be up to date with every single little thing that's going on in the cyber world. But it's you understand what this generation coming through are. How they're communicating, how they're socializing. You know, sometimes I've known the results of some of my athletes online or on Twitter before they've told me. So, you know, these are valuable sources and valuable tools that we can use as coaches.
Yeah, for sure, Alistair. I mean, it definitely shows how much you are invested in the athlete, and then in return, they're going to, you know, you're going to earn their trust. So we've talked about some great strategies for coaches, but on the other hand, can you tell us maybe a couple crucial mistakes that coaches make when working with players and parents?
I think, you know, we've touched on it already. They don't set their standards from day one. They don't make them clear enough where the boundaries are, what's accepted, what's not accepted, how we run things around here. For example, time management, dress code, communication, these type of things, those aren't clearly communicated. Second of all, expectations of the athlete. We've got to understand that parents have expectations that are 3, 4, 5 times higher than our expectations as coaches or their kids. Every parent thinks that their kid is going to be the next champion, or should I say most parents think their kid is going to be the next Wimbledon champion or US Open champion, whatever it may be. So we have to lay those expectations down, because if you're going along with that as a coach and saying, yes, 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 I agree, and their kid isn't getting to a certain level by the age of 12, 14, etc., then they're not going to believe in your stories and your theories and your methodology anymore, for example. The third biggest mistake, I believe, is that coaches want to jump in and fix everything as fast as they can without giving that time to connect and to better understand the athlete. And, you know, we've got two ears, one mouth. So in my opinion, we've got to listen twice as much as we speak. And I think this is a big mistake coaches make, is that we want to talk, we want to fill the gaps instead of using that time to actually listen and take as much information as possible from the athlete and the parents themselves, because they know that child or that athlete better than we do as coaches. So, you know, those would be the three things I'd feel that coaches make mistakes in.
Fantastic, Alistair. Appreciate that. And so, speaking to the parents, what is the optimal role that a parent can play to best support their children who want to be a future elite athletes?
Well, I just think you said the key word there, support and unconditional love. Mm-hmm. Not putting expectations and unnecessary pressure on that kid, especially if they begin to start to do well in a sport, for example. But their role is to facilitate, support, encourage, love, unconditionally, regardless of how that kid wins, loses, whatever level they may be. Not to compare with other kids. You know, you hear that, you know, like, why don't you do it like Jill, or why don't you work as hard as Mark, for example. Those are not good ways to encourage a kid in a sport. So those would be the main roles of a parent, is to support, obviously not to coach. And, you know, that's an area I spend a lot of time in when I do the workshops with coaches or academies, and we'll have some time along for the parents as well. And those are the areas we look at in terms of the right things to say before a match, or when you're in the car, for example, the right things to say on the way home from a match or from a competition, for example. So, it is our job as coaches to educate parents. So it is our job to understand what the roles are, make them clear from day one, the standards and the expectations of each person's role. It's athlete-driven, or should I say, sorry, athlete-centered, parent-supported, and coach-driven. And that's how it should be.
Beautifully put. So Alistair, shifting to the player, you know, in tennis, a lot of players, when they make errors, they tend to focus more on their stroke technique and things like that. But I think a lot of athletes neglect, or I'm sorry, a lot of tennis players neglect the role of being a better athlete. So can you talk to us about the importance of being an athlete and the impact it has on a tennis player's game and career?
Well, we just have to look at all the best athletes out there today, and you'll see that more than 70-80% played multiple sports up until the age of 13-14. You know, I've given a lot of examples of athletes I've worked with, for example, Xavier Melis, Bernard Tomic, Alex Bogomolov Jr., Svetlana Kuznetsova. These players are all great athletes. They can play basketball, they can play soccer, they can play sports. They're not just one-dimensional and only know how to hit a tennis ball. And you find this also with, you know, you look at athletes like Jordan Spieth. He was a really good football and baseball player up until the age of 13, 14. So we need to understand that better players come from better athletic backgrounds, not just from a skills point of view, from athletic skills or neuromuscular point of view, but from an ability to withstand the pressures of the training load that's going to be happening if they're getting more serious. So their bodies are more able to withstand impact, force. They're less injured, for example. You'll see a lot of players that have just been one-dimensional, especially kids around about the age of 15, 16 that have just been playing one sport, are more injured than kids that have been playing multiple sports. Plus, the hours and time from a young age of just playing one sport, the risk of burnout by the age of 14, 15 is quadrupled in terms of that kid has only just played one sport, for example. And I have seen with my own eyes in some of the travels I've done around the world and visiting academies, really, really good 14, 15-year-old tennis players that aren't great athletes. And I can tell you that they're only going to get so far and no further. Number one, they're either going to get burned out. Number two, injured. or number three, they just don't have the athleticism of what it takes to get to the top, because this is an incredibly physical game right now. And we just have to look at the top and see how Novak is dominating. Somebody that is just an incredible athlete that spends a lot of time on his flexibility, his mobility, his physical training. I was in Indian Wells 2 weeks ago, California, and witnessed his warm-up, which took between an hour and a half and 2 hours, consisting of at least 30 to 40 mobility and flexibility exercises before he started his agility and movement warm-up. And that just shows you what type of athletes we're dealing with today.
That's truly amazing. It's staggering to pretty much everyone to hear that. That's amazing. On this podcast, I've had a couple athletes, such as world number 30 Tread Huey in doubles, have a rocket serve, and he told me that he played a lot of baseball when he was young. So what I'd like to ask you is, what are some other sports that best translate to tennis that you would encourage other tennis players to perhaps take up?
I mean, this can be a personal thing, but my two favorites for sure are soccer for the foot skills and the space and positional awareness on a field, of looking for gaps, of anticipating movements, anticipating specific places where you're going to be playing the ball. And basketball, because of the hand skills and the incredible agility skills you get from basketball. So those are two great sports that I love to mix into some of the training of the athletes I work with. But there's other sports, for example, that I've incorporated into the junior programs, especially, that include a mixture of – I call it handball, but it's a mixture of netball, basketball – where you work with different skills, neuromuscular skills of only catching the ball one hand, a tennis ball one hand, a non-dominant hand, using basketballs, tennis balls, all these type of things, you know. So, a coach can be creative and bring out a lot of games there and have the kids play. I mean, even like hockey, for example, using the rackets as the hockey sticks and having four aside or three kids aside and two goals on either side. Those are great things to create a great energy, a great spirit, a great warm-up, and of course, great agility drills.
That's fantastic, Alistair. And so let's say if we have a player who now understands how important it is to be a better athlete, what are some of the basic fundamentals that you would tell this tennis player that he or she should concentrate on to become a better athlete?
Doing the small things incredibly well and consistently well, warming up well, preparing well, making sure that they have the right foods, the right drinks, the right snacks, the right clothes, the right shoes, all these small little things that are so important that again, these are things that we give accountability and responsibility to, the overlooked things. I can always tell the quality of a coach's program and the dedication of an athlete by just watching their warm-up. If their warm-up is sloppy, they're cutting corners, it's half-hearted, then you already see where the mindset of the athlete is or the quality of the program of that coach. So, you know, Coach Wooden, the legendary basketball coach, would even take notes watching the warm-ups of his players. That's how detailed Coach Wooden was, making sure that everything, all those areas that people mostly overlook, were taken care of. But if I could give advice to a young athlete, that would be listen well to your coach. When you step onto that court, everything is professional. Everything is done the best of your ability, be it the warm-up, be it the drills, the exercises, whatever it may be. And then understand that the mindset that you develop is practiced on or it's taken from the practice court. You just don't all of a sudden become a positive person in a match or competition. You'd like to think you do, but you don't rise to your levels. You sink to the habits that you've created in your practices. So make sure those habits and your practices are the best they can be, and that's going to come out under pressure situations in your competition.
Fantastic, Alistair. And this is what you commonly refer to as the 1%. Is that right?
Those are the 1%, yeah. The 1% are just doing those small things incredibly well, making sure you're well hydrated, having a protein shake after a practice to delay your body's in a catabolic state, getting good sleep, getting good nutrition. These are all the 1% that are controllables that so many athletes don't get right. They think it's the bigger things and how many hours of training they're doing, for example, when it's not. Getting all those 1% in place. Another great example of a 1% was Coach Wooden teaching his players how to tie their laces properly. And you might laugh at that, but with 2 seconds on the buzzer and your lace comes undone and you can't get to that ball, that's game over. And these are small little things that we call the 1%, taking care of the 1%.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Right. And, the game and matches are, the margins are razor thin. It just takes 1 point or so, and that'll decide the match. So these 1% are extremely important.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. And so, Alistair, can you tell us maybe just a couple of your favorite drills that you like to employ with your players to improve their agility, speed, and balance?
What drills I do? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, perhaps maybe one or two on court or off court. Just any type of drill.
Well, obviously it's difficult to explain that over a podcast and not seeing it, but I'm going to keep it very simple. I go over fundamentals 80% of the time. How to properly lateral shuffle, how to properly decelerate, how to properly accelerate, how to change direction. Fundamentals that are repeated over and over and over. Those are 80%. I can tell you that observing one of my lessons would probably be boring or uninteresting for an observer because I go over the fundamentals of learning the posture, the body position, the correct ground force application of the feet, all these things that are important for an athlete to move well. I'm not 10 years ago, I was big into finding the latest drills and spills and thrills on the internet of what was going on and thinking that was what, great agility was. It isn't. It's going over the fundamentals. So, like I said, watching or observing one of my practice sessions would probably be pretty boring or thinking, well, hey, there's nothing special there. That is exactly where the secret lies to success is. Repeating the fundamentals and doing them consistently well.
Oh, that's very powerful advice, Alistair. Appreciate that as well.
And I'm sorry I couldn't give you guys any fancy new drills or fun things or I'm doing the T drill or whatever it may be, but that's what it comes down to. It's not going to excite a lot of people, but the fundamentals aren't sexy, but boy, do they get results.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely agreed. And so, Alistair, I've heard you talk about the importance of stretching and how it arguably was the most important part of Novak's rise. And can you talk to and speak to people who think that who say that they don't have the time to stretch and how important stretching is?
Well, those who don't have the time to stretch now are going to have to find time for the physio table later.
That's right.
That's what it comes down to because it's just waiting to happen. You can get away with it when you're a kid. You can get away with it maybe in your early 20s, but you don't get away with it once you get to your mid 20s, late 20s, early 30s. It catches up with you, and it's definitely one thing that has stunted the longevity of a lot of athletes' careers. You know, where they're still great players, but they're just getting injured into their late 20s or early 30s. So again, there's a 1%. How much time are you putting into your stretching, your flexibility, your regeneration, your foam rolling? your preparation? Are you doing the extra 15 minutes a day at home by yourself? Great athletes are self-motivated to do these things by themselves. They don't have to wait for their coach or their mom or dad to say, hey, go stretch. Hey, go cool down. Hey, have you done your foam rolling, for example? They're motivated to do these things because they understand those are the areas where they can gain an advantage on other athletes. So, you know, we use a simple system with the McCall Method stretch strap, which is four simple stretches after training. Now, you can say, well, only four stretches? I've tried to give athletes 10, 15 stretches that I feel are necessary after a practice, but it doesn't work. It's too much. I keep it realistic, and if I can get my athletes to stretch these four simple stretches, which take 3 minutes per leg, I've achieved something. That is better than nothing, or that is better than they sometimes do it and they sometimes don't. You know, it's part of that deal where, hey, you've got 5-6 minutes to do these four stretches. They're going to work around the hip. You know, we're going to work around the hamstring. We're going to work around the quad, the hip flexor, the QL, the lower back, etc. Do those every day. Do those consistently every day. And over a year, you've built up 20, 30 hours of flexibility and mobility work. Is that going to make a difference? You bet it is.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's really crucial to recovery and flexibility. And you know, I think now more people are understanding the difference between dynamic and static stretching. But is it correct to assume that we would optimally do dynamic stretching before a competition than static after? How is the general arrangement? How should we be splitting time with those?
Yeah. You definitely want to prepare the body where you're working through movement preparation before you play. So, you know, you're going to be putting your joints, your muscles into positions that they're going to be performing when you play. So that's why it's important to work through a dynamic flexibility program before you play. So, for example, tennis is multidirectional. We'll be putting in some linear stretch lunges, for example. We'll be putting in some side lunges. We'll be putting in some hamstring stretches, for example, because we're going to be accelerating. So you specifically prepare those dynamic flexibility exercises for the nature of the movements and the sport you're going to be playing. Afterwards, the body's nice and warm, the blood's still flowing. We get what I call an advantage window of being able to straight away after practice sit down, take out the stretch strap, and work on the range of motion because that body's nice and warm. We can take that leg a little bit more backwards. We can take that leg out to the side a little bit more further. We can get more range in the adductors. We can get more range in the hip flexors. So, you know, they talk about, well, I'm going to, you know, some kids will say, or some athletes will say, well, I'm going to go home and stretch. No, that's not good enough because we've got to take advantage of that window straight after training to stretch straight away because we can get more range when the body's warm, when there's a good core body temperature.
Right. And Alistair, something that some of our audience has asked is in regards to the weight room, is there an ideal rep range or set number that tennis players should be following, or does that just depend whether you're on off season or on season?
There's not a huge difference because I believe you should be training all components all year round. Speed should be trained all year round. Endurance should be trained all round. Strength should be trained all round. So, yes, we do have a period, for example, in the off season, let's call it December, to do a little bit more heavier work, if we want to call it that. But range, anywhere between 8 and 15 repetitions, depending on what you're looking for. During season, I'll usually have my athletes on a range of, say, 12 to 15 repetitions, 3 sets, 4 sets, very basic stuff. But again, it all depends on the athlete. What can they handle? What can they take? What has their history been in the weight room? That's another area. You can't just take 6 or 10, 14-year-olds and give them all the same program because some might have no history in the weights area and some might have a vast history there in the weight area. So all these things are all different when it comes to that area. That is why it's so important that you find a strength and conditioning coach that understands the athlete, that understands the workload, that understands the history and what that athlete can do and can't do.
So when a player gets injured, you know, what should their approach be? Should they be trying to strengthen other areas of their body? Or, I mean, what is the optimal approach once a player gets injured to get them back on the court or field as soon as possible?
Well, first things first, they need to get the best advice. They need to obviously get great medical advice and then taken through the various stages of how they're going to rehab that and get back. But I always say that a setback, like an injury, is a great opportunity for a great comeback. So there's always something you can do. You know, if you've injured an ankle, there's always areas you can work on. For example, the hips, the glutes, the core, upper body, rotational power, increase the range of motion in the rotators, shoulders, etc. There's always things you can do, and vice versa. Injury to the upper body, for example, you can strengthen those legs. You can still do cardio. You can still work on things in the lower limbs, for example. So, you know, again, that is another area that I believe is on the athlete. The passion and the hunger of the athlete is someone who wants to do, who just wants to work out, get better, train hard. They're always like, you know, they're almost pushy and irritating, you know, like, oh, well, I can do this, or maybe I can do that. And hey, I can do that. And you know, they're always looking for ways to get better and not being told, hey, get into the gym and you can work on other things. Those are the small differences between the players and the athletes that go on to great things and the players that don't. The ones that are like, oh, okay, this is a good chance just to chill out and play more Xbox and do whatever and goof off. You know, the passionate players are always looking for things to do, even when they're injured.
How can you prevent imbalances?
Well, the way I work with imbalances are two things, specifically two things, if I can call it that, is I believe in alignment. So I'll have my athletes visit a chiropractor once a month to be aligned, hips and the spine. And I do that myself as a coach. And second of all, working in a more unilateral way of training, single leg, one side of the body, working at a time, and then bilateral strength after that. So when we train with, for example, one leg off the ground, we're strengthening that one side, which is starting to strengthen the body and balance the body individually. So single leg squat, for example, training on my strong leg, I do 10 reps. Training on my weaker leg, I might struggle to do 10 reps. But if I've got both feet on the ground, then my right leg is always going to be doing more of that work. It might be 20%, 30%, for example. So with both feet on the ground, I might be getting stronger, but my stronger side is still stronger than my weaker, substantially, because it keeps, when it gets fatigued, it wants to keep pushing off on that stronger side. So to create imbalances, we need to include more unilateral strength training, opposite arm to opposite leg, lunges, single leg squats, split squats, single arm shoulder press, single arm row, all these type of exercises that are working one side of the body at a time. Working with dumbbells, working with medicine balls, BOSUs, resistance tubes, these are all great ways to strengthen the body in a unilateral way. So basically, in a nutshell, that comes down to not training on machines. Is there a place for machines in the program? Absolutely. I would say 20% of the time I use machines. Sometimes use a leg press, leg extension, for example. However, we need to understand that sport is in a standing upright position, unless you're rowing, of course. But in tennis, for example, you're standing on your two feet. When you move, you're taking one foot off the ground. So we need to be stable. We need to be balanced. We need to be strong on one single leg at a time.
Fantastic advice about imbalances and unilateral strength. Alistair, I had a fan question regarding your thoughts on diet and nutrition. So is there a certain diet that you think's best, or does it just vary among the athlete?
It varies amongst the athletes. I mean, we look at Novak, it's what we can call extreme. But again, there's another 1% of why he is the best. He takes care of all those little areas. But, you know, definitely for athletes, it can be different, you know. However, when I work with an athlete, it is definitely an area I like to look into. Again, I've got to make that connection before I can make any changes. However, the small things, are they getting a good breakfast? Are they hydrating consistently throughout the day? Are they getting enough protein? Are they getting the right amount of carbohydrates? Are they taking the right vitamins and supplements to help them with their recovery and with their preparation? These are all things you need to look into. You need to get the big rocks right first. And one of the biggest areas most athletes fail is that they just don't have a good enough breakfast. They're in a rush out of the house to get to training, or they're maybe having a breakfast that consists of too much sugar. They're having cereals that are loaded with sugar and who knows what, Cocoa Pops and whatever you have out there. You know, you got to treat your body like a car. You know, if you're driving a Ferrari, you're going to be putting premium super fuel in it. You're not going to be putting the cheapest fuel in it. So, you know, you've got to think of yourself as a car. How are you treating the car? How are you maintaining the car? Are you maintaining that car every day? Are you checking the tires? Are you checking the suspension? Are you checking all these type of things that need to be checked, or are you just letting it go, for example? The quality of your fuel is exactly the same as the quality of your nutrition. What fuel are you putting into your body? Junk? Well, you're going to get junk performance. That's how it works.
Yeah, beautiful advice, Alistair. You know, Alistair has a training session coming up soon, so I'm just going to try to shove in a few fan questions in here.
And it's my own training session.
Oh, it's your own training. That's right.
I'm training myself. Yes.
Fantastic. Yeah, Alistair is. I think you're training for a marathon. Is that right?
Well, quite a few actually, but obviously the big one this year is New York. So preparation has started, and this is one thing I want to tell the viewers out there, especially coaches, that the most important appointment of the day is with yourself. You've got to make that time for yourself. Otherwise, in this business of serving others, you're gonna neglect yourself, neglect your health. That's why I said that's the most important appointment of the day is with myself. It's my stretching in the morning for 20 minutes, and then it's my running or my strength session in the afternoon.
For sure. I mean, Alistair clearly, he walks the walk, and he needs to look after his health and longevity as well. Because if you can't, if you're not healthy, then you can't serve others.
Exactly. And that's a big area I've been, my book is coming out in June, and it's seven keys to being a great coach. And one of those areas is about investing in yourself as a coach. And a big section of that is about taking care of your own health and taking care of your own wellness and making that time for yourself, which in coaching is so important, because we can become a slave to the program. We can become a slave to the athletes. Our weekends are taken, and it's just so important. If you know, you can't give energy if you don't have it. So that's a big area.
Fantastic, Alistair. So let's see, with the fan questions, Victor from Maryland, he's curious about matches in extreme heat. So he asks, how do you firstly prepare for a match in extreme heat? And then what should you do during the match? And then how can you recover quickly from this type of environment?
All right. Good question. I'm going to keep it simple.
Sure.
Prepare in those conditions. Don't always plan your practices when it's in the cool of the day, for example, early morning or late evening. Sometimes, maybe once or twice a week, go out in the middle of the day. Maybe shorten your practice. So if you usually have a practice for an hour and a half, maybe do an hour in the heat. Second of all, hydration doesn't just start when you walk on the court. Hydration starts the day before. So what am I saying? Hydration is all the time. You can't just be all of a sudden drinking a lot of fluid on the court. That is trying to catch up. Your body is in a delayed process the whole time. It's working 8 hours before. So your body is already in a dehydrated state when you wake up. Why? Because you've been sleeping under your blankets, your body's warm, and you've actually been sweating through the night. So you've been losing fluid. So there is one. The minute you wake up, get into the great habit of having a glass of water, getting your body into a hydration status. Drink a lot of water, drink before, drink during, and drink after. Stay well hydrated. Another area is wear a hat. Wear sun cream. We lose a lot of energy through burning of the skin and through the heat through the head. So those are just three simple tips that I'm sure he's heard before or your listeners have heard, but these are three simple tips that I still today need to remind the elite athletes I work with. So I hope those help, Victor.
I appreciate that. And Doug, who's a head coach of the Tennessee at Towson University, is wondering about your thoughts on distance running for stamina and what is the best way to train your stamina for tennis players?
Okay. You've got to look at the sport and train specific to the sport. So does endurance running help? No. You could be doing something a lot more worthwhile. So, for example, doing interval type of work, hill training, for example, which is increasing your strength endurance. Those would be better options. Even training in the sand, where you know you're still getting a great effect on the cardiovascular system, a strength element as well. So you can have intervals, for example, of 2 minutes on the sand sprints, for example, followed by a 2 minute recovery. We can do hill sprints, 100, 200 yard hill sprints, for example, or longer if you want to increase that endurance. But we need to understand that tennis players don't run further than, for example, 5 yards, 10 yards in the furthest distance before they have to stop again. And excuse me if I'm wrong there because I work in meters, which is a European metric, but you're not running far before you have to stop again. So our energy systems and our muscular systems are a lot different to, for example, an endurance runner who's consistently working on, let's for example, 1,000 strides per mile. That is a different system altogether. So, you know, if he enjoys taking the group out for a 3 mile run once a week, no problem. However, if you're doing long runs at 60% or 70% of your maximum heart rate, thinking that's going to improve your endurance on the court, it's not going to be a great difference. There are better things you can be doing in that time. For example, like I said, sand sprints, hill intervals, or even intervals in the track, for example. Those would be better options.
Great, Alistair. One last fan question very quickly. Paul from Virginia, ice baths, are they effective for recovery?
Personally speaking, I haven't felt a huge advantage on it. When I was training for 7 marathons and 7 half marathons in 7 weeks, I tried a whole load of I used myself as an experiment to see what would work best and what the athlete goes through. So I fatigued my body and hurt my body over those 7 weeks quite a bit running those distances. The biggest, believe it or not, the biggest area where I found the most benefit was consistent myofascial release, foam rolling, self-massage, and my flexibility consistently. I tried cryotherapy in the cryotherapy tanks. I tried ice baths. I'm not going to say they do help or they don't. However, I didn't see a huge difference in my performance or the way I felt the next day. But however, I'm not saying they don't work because a lot of athletes I've spoken to swear by it. I would say on the tour right now, it's divided with a 50-50 of athletes who use it and don't. However, and this might relate to Victor as well, in extreme heat conditions, above 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees Celsius, I'll have my athletes get in a ice bath after a training session or a match that consists of 2 hours or longer. So hopefully that answers the question.
Fantastic, Alistair. And just, yeah, any last words of wisdom for players and coaches on becoming better athletes and coaches?
Well, what you're doing right now, if you're listening to this podcast and you've got this far, congratulations, and I hope I haven't bored you guys too much. If you're listening to podcasts and you're reading and you're doing these things, you are ahead of the 99% who aren't. And invest in yourself. Listen to podcasts. Read good books. Associate yourself with experienced coaches. This is how you're going to grow as a coach. And there's no better investment you can make in yourself. So I want to congratulate you and give you that advice that just keep investing in yourself and keep wanting to learn and grow.
Fantastic, Alistair. And where can our audience find you?
Twitter, @AlistairMcCall, Facebook, McCaw Method. And my email is McCaw Method, McCawMethod.com. Oh, sorry. I think I might have messed that up. McCawMethod@AOL.com. My apologies.
No worries, Alistair. I'll definitely post that in the show notes.
I got lost on that one. Sorry.
No worries, Alistair. Well, I just want to really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for all the work that you're doing, for bringing on the show, and for just the impact that you've had on so many individuals, and for your passion and motivation. It's truly appreciated, and you're providing everyone with a great service. And I really encourage everyone to check out Alistair's website and social media pages, because you're going to benefit a lot just from reading his updates. It's going to really pump you up. So, Alistair, thanks so much. I wish you all the best with the book coming out. I'll definitely grab a copy. And, you know, thanks so much for being on the show.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
I hope you learned a ton from my interview with Alistair McCaw. I just really took great pleasure in absorbing all the information from Alistair through all his experiences coaching the best athletes in the world. And again, Alistair, thank you so much for your time today. If you'd like to get the show notes for this episode, you can visit tennisfiles.com/11. I want you to take Alistair's advice to heart and really implement the advice that he talked to us about today. He's had experience with the greatest athletes, and he knows what it takes to become a champion. And so if you are motivated to become a better tennis player and a better athlete, and you implement his advice, then you will be on your way to reaching your tennis potential. So I'd really appreciate also if you guys would take the time to write a review for the Tennis Files podcast. If you have some time, you can just go to tennisfiles.com/iTunes, and also subscribe if you want to get the episodes that I publish immediately downloaded to your podcast app. I wish you guys all the best, and I just want to read you a quote that is really inspiring to me. And this quote is from General George S. Patton, and he wrote, "You must be single-minded. Drive for the one thing on which you have decided." So I want you all again to just focus on your goals, pick one thing that you want to improve upon, and just go out there and figure out what you need to do and do it. So I wish everyone the best. And thank you so much for listening to this episode of Tennis Files Podcast. And I look forward to serving you and helping you to become a better tennis player. Take care, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files Podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.